Welcome to the Devil's Porridge Museum podcast. On this week's podcast, we're delighted to be talking to local historian and author David Ramshaw about his book, The Carlisle Ship Canal, 1821 to 1853. David had been scheduled to talk at the museum this week before the lockdown restrictions were introduced, and we hope that today's podcast can be an introduction to some of the themes that would have been covered in that talk. So, David, thank you very much for coming on our podcast today and agreeing to talk about your book, The Carlisle Ship Canal. You were obviously going to be doing a talk last night at the museum, which has unfortunately had to be cancelled, but we're thrilled that you could join us today in this format. So the first thing I thought we could talk about was the conception of the canal and why it was developed. Because in my mind, Carlisle's quite close to the Solway anyway. And I often tend to think of canals as being part of a longer distance connection, perhaps more like the Forth and Clyde Canal, further north than Scotland.
Yes, well, it was indeed. I mean, Carlisle did have what you call Port Carlisle way back into the 18th century. But Port Carlisle is just basically a jetty at a farm near Rockcliffe. And because it was so far down the estuary, could only take quite small boats, up to maybe 40, 50 tons, and then only on high tides. And then there was a 3-mile trek into Carlisle with horses and carts to carry any goods that had come in. So it wasn't very satisfactory. But just at the end of the 18th century, there was a lot of trouble in Ireland at that time, and they wanted to be able to get troops quickly across to Ireland without taking them across, go around the north or down past the south. Sure. And plans were made for a canal to go directly from Newcastle right across to Maryport, effectively. That was about right at the end of the 18th century. And they were drawn up, and there's a lot in the newspapers about it, saying, you know, if you had so many thousand navvies based at Hexham, you could shifting so much rubble in so much time, it could be done in a certain time. But nothing ever happened because it was quite a considerable venture to go all the way across. And Carlisle was in a strange position in that everything through Carlisle was very industrialised, but it was all water. And several rivers going through, particularly the Caldew, and everything was run by water. And yet in other parts of the country, steam engines were being introduced. The problem with Carlisle was that coal at Carlisle cost at least four times what it did at Maryport. And this was because it had to be brought at great expense, occasionally when it was possible, down to the Port Carlisle at Sandsfield, and then by horse and cart transferred into Carlisle. So that wasn't very good. And they'd been looking forward to this canal coming, and nothing happened. They tried to revive the idea in the early part of the 19th century, still nothing happened. And the industry in Carlisle, the business owners, were getting left behind. And so what did they do? They got in touch with William Chapman, who'd drawn up the original plans, and said, look, can you not build us a canal just from Carlisle to the coast? And he looked into that, and he said, yes, we can. And they looked at the price and everything, and they decided, yes, to go ahead. And this is about 1817, the charter, they got permission to build the canal. So that's how it came about.
So that must have, with the change in industry, moving on to the kind of coal-powered and the steam-powered industry there rather than water-powered, must have completely revolutionised and changed Carlisle.
It did. It made a fantastic difference because the canal was built over 4 or 5 years, and it was partly opened from about 1819, but it was properly opened in 1823, and there's big celebrations when that happened, and they had a procession of ships come from Bruff, which is halfway along the canal, carrying all these different goods, coal in particular. And the price of coal immediately dropped to the same price as more or less as at Maryport, 1.5 pence a peck as opposed to 6 pence a peck. And so in the succeeding years after that, business really took off. Biggest biscuit factory in the world eventually in 1836 was built, Cow's Biscuits, right on the edge of the canal basin. Cow's biscuits go very well by water. They don't travel very well by horse and cow. But it was a lake canal. Anyway, 1836, they built Dixon's Chimney, the biggest chimney in Europe at that time, and the biggest spinning mill. That was only a few hundred yards from the canal. And there were items in the newspaper about how raw cotton was brought in, and they actually had competition where they tried to produce the cotton, produce a dress, and get it exported again, and managed to do that in about a week.
Oh, wow.
That sort of thing was going on, and all sorts of strange things they'd never seen before, like pineapples and coconuts were coming into the city. You've got to remember that the people in Carlisle themselves, it was like the space age coming to them, because a lot of them had never left the city. A lot had never seen a ship. They might have seen a boat on the river, but not a masted ship. And when ships up to 110 tons came in right through into the centre of the city, sailing through what had been previously fields, they just couldn't believe it. And it really was a big change to them. And Carlisle really expanded in the next 30 years.
So would it be fair to say that it went from being, a relatively speaking, a backwater or secondary industrial city to very much a forefront with the largest factory and tallest chimney and kind of leading in that sort of sense what was going on? And it must have changed Port Carlisle tremendously as well, if it was just a jetty.
Yes. The actual canal didn't go to Maryport. It went to a place called Fisher's Cross. Which was one building, a custom house. They had several custom houses along the course because of the smuggling that went on in the 18th, 19th century. There was very little there, a couple of farms and this custom house. And within the length of the canal, within 20 years, they built a village. The houses to rent and to buy, it became a resort as well as an industrial place, Port Carlisle. They changed the name to Port Carlisle. And it really expanded the use of the canal. But one of the problems with the canal was that it was based on the Forth and Clyde Canal, and they had a lot of problems with the locks initially. They eventually used the same pattern as on the Forth and Clyde, and they incurred a lot of expenditure in the years that they were starting up. And effectively had to borrow about half of the money that was needed. And as a result, the canal never really paid very well to the shareholders because they were paying off loans to the banks. And not only that, only about four or five years after the canal had opened, coming from Newcastle by horse and cart in pieces and then put on the canal, were engines, steam engines, going down to Rainhill for the trials, for getting a mobile steam engine. Stevenson's was one of those. And so this was foretelling the end of the canal, which had only been open 4 or 5 years. And actually that led to Carlisle getting the earliest cross-country steam train. By 1836, we had Newcastle-Carlisle Railway. And that was started by the canal because they were doing quite well, apart from the fact that they weren't paying the shareholders very much. And so in 1828, they said, why not extend the canal to Newcastle, as originally thought, and maybe to Cooley Bridge to bring Slade to Bullswater. And William Chapman looked into the costs, well over about £888,000 to put all these culverts and locks and across to Newcastle. Whereas they looked at the cost of a railway, and at this time, when this was being done, there were no more about steam engines. It would have been a railway pulled by horses and steam engines at the tops of the hill to pull them up, as they used in quarries and places like that. And they came up with a quarter of that price. So they said, we'll go ahead with that. And it was opened about 1832, but fully opened when they could get right through to Newcastle by 1836, the first cross-country railway. So when you see the plans of the basin at Carlisle, you see the railways coming in by the 1830s.
almost like a lovely poetic nature to the idea of Stevenson's rocket being taken along the canal, yes. With the canal's been very much the industrial forerunner of the railway.
Yes.
Which I suppose ultimately replaced them, and that's why it's such a short-lived part of the industrial time period.
Yeah, it was, and it may have gone on longer, but the Maryport Railway was built, Maryport to Carlisle, and the person who was the person who had the who was getting money from the canal in service, so many pence per ton, Lord Lonsdale, he had a lot of shares in the Maryport Railway, and I think he was making a lot more money out of the Maryport Railway than out of the canal. And quite a lot went on. In particular, a jetty was built south of the, well, east of the canal at Manitouit at Ravenbank. And he said he was building this jetty to build up the mudflats further down to Brough to get more land. And other people who said, no, that won't happen. You'll block up the entrance to the canal. And surely that's what happened, and got the Admiralty involved. And it took 2 or 3 years to get that jetty removed. And within a few weeks of that happening, it cleared the entrance to the canal. All these ships, hundreds of tons of shale disappeared, and ships, the Newcastle steamer, one quite a large steamer, which went from Liverpool up to Annan Waterfoot and then across it, they could get into the, back into the, not into the canal itself, but into the dock at Carlisle. And at Port Carlisle. And it showed that, you know, the canal by that time was losing a lot of money. And so they decided, let's drain it and let's replace it with the railway. And that happened within a year. They were putting tenders out to lay the rails before they'd even drained it.
And does the railway run along the same route, the same line as the canal?
This is why it was so easy to do, because they only had 8 locks, most of them going through Brough by Sands, and all they had to do was level out where the locks had been, basically.
Yeah.
It was already flat. So people travelling to Port Carlisle, they were travelling a lot of the time in sort of a viaduct. We couldn't see that very much because they're in the bottom of the canal. They filled it up with, obviously, with stone, and then the railway on top. But you can still see parts of it now, where the Silloth Railway went. Because within a year, they built a junction at Drumbrough, which is two-thirds of the way to Port Carlisle. And that junction went on to a place called Silloth. And Silloth was just one or two houses, farms and things, very little. And Carr built a mill there, a flour mill. And they started building houses. Guest houses, and all of the people who'd gone to Port Carlisle to play tennis, to go to the baths, because there were seawater baths there, and to play balls and get the sea air, so they started going to Silloth instead. And Silloth was built up over the next 20, 30 years. And the ships registered at Silloth are actually Carlisle registered, it's CA, and that is because Silloth became the new Port Carlisle.
So you mentioned the different raw materials and produce that was coming in once the canal was operational, and pineapples and exotic things from around the world that the people of Carlisle had never kind of seen before. And also there was biscuits going out from cars and the other factories, and the cotton and the linen side of it as well. But was there a lot of people travelling through the port in that time?
Yes, indeed. A lot of people emigrated. I mean, this was a time of the Scottish clearances, and you know, there was a lot of poverty in the countryside, in Cumbria as well, and on the continent. There's a lot of refugees from the continent across to Newcastle, and then they came by railway from Newcastle to Carlisle, and then they would get down to the canal basin, probably by horse-drawn omnibus, and go along the canal. There was a hotel at Port Carlisle where they would stay overnight. And then they'd catch a steamer next day down to Liverpool or to Annan Waterfoot to get their ship to take them to Canada, or Upper Canada in particular. And over a 3 or 4 month period, if you read the local newspapers, there were thousands of people went that way, and also some very poor Cumbrians also went the same way. And the stories are in the book taken from the newspaper showing you who they were and what they were doing.
Going back to the commerce side of it, though, where were the ships trading with that were coming in and out of Carlisle?
The main trade was with the Baltic. From Baltic in particular, timber from the Memel River, Russian timber. And Carlisle is basically built on Memel timber, the original houses. And you see it advertised in the newspapers at the time, freshly in from the Baltic, this Memel timber. And they built ships in Carlisle, of course. Over the 20, 30 years it was opened, I can't remember the straight number, it's in the book, but quite a few ships were built in Carlisle, built at the canal base. And these were ships up to 110 tons. And it was a shipbuilding port as well as exporting. That seems strange when you look at it now down Caldergate to think we're building ships there.
And all this industry really did stem from the development of the canal.
Yeah, it really did make, the canal was the initial impetus that really made the difference to Carlisle. The railways then took over and it became a railway city.
Well, David, thank you very much. Having spoken to you today again, I'm really sorry that you couldn't deliver your talk. We can hopefully reschedule sometime and get you to come back to the museum, because I'm sure the kind of full talk with the images and things like that that you add to the presentation would be fascinating. And I'd certainly love to hear more of it sometime. But thank you very much for taking part in our podcast today.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to giving the proper PowerPoint talk at the museum sometime. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Devil's Porridge Museum podcast. Remember, you can catch up on previous pods through our website, and keep checking our social media for updates on new podcast releases.